This is the lecture tape for May 26, 1999. We're continuing on with Joshua chapters 14 to 21, and today's lesson is division of the Promised Land. Up to this point now, Joshua and Israel have defeated all the major Canaanite kings and their armies. They have captured the major influential cities, whether they're on the crossroads or trade routes, and they have all returned back to Gilgal. And we learned the significance of that last week when we discovered that the battle was fought with 10 to 12 inch swords, and the fact that all the enemy was killed and yet none of Israel was. Back at Gilgal, they are finally ready to receive their inheritance from the Lord. In Numbers 26, we read that the allotment of the inheritance was to be based on size, meaning that the larger tribes would receive the larger inheritance, while the smaller tribes would receive the smaller inheritance. The division would be done by casting lots before the Lord, and that would be done by Joshua, the leader, Eleazar, the high priest, and the Urim and Thummim were the dice, if you will, possibly stones, maybe sticks. They were kept in the breastplate pocket of the high priest, and these would be thrown or cast in a lap, and at that time a question would be asked, and the answer would come up either yes or no from the Lord. That is the process that they would go through to receive their inheritance. And we find that representatives of each of the remaining 9.5 tribes now will also be present at the casting of the lots. The 2.5 tribes already have their inheritance on the Transjordan or across the Jordan side. Prior to the allotment, we come to a story about Caleb. And Caleb, along with Joshua, was one of the 12 original spies that had gone into the land. He comes before Joshua and asks that he be given the portion of the land that the Lord had already allotted to him and which Moses had given to him as an inheritance. Look at chapter 14, verse 6. It reads, "Now the men of Judah approached Joshua at Gilgal, and Caleb, son of Jephunne, the Kenizzite." And I want to stop here because we learn a lot of things. First off, when Caleb came before Joshua, he didn't come alone. He brought all the leadership from Judah, showing a unity in his request. This was agreeable to all within his tribe. Next, Caleb is called the son of a Kenizzite. Now, the Kenizzites are also called Kenites, and we've already run into one who is Hobab. That was Moses' brother-in-law, and you remember Moses said to his brother-in-law, "Stay with us in the wilderness here because you're familiar with the area and you can help us." The name actually means copper worker. It's more of a title, and it's taken up then as a tribe name. They are the copper workers. Now, we find that Caleb's father is a Kenizzite, and through Scripture we can document that he came to Egypt, and he married the daughter from a tribe of Judah. When their first son was born, he was named Caleb, meaning all heart, after her family clan, and the family clan was Carmi. And Carmi and Caleb apparently are of the same derivation. We also discovered that as a young man, Caleb becomes the chief of her clan. So that's how he becomes one of the leaders of the tribe of Judah. In verse 12, we read, "Now give me this hill country that the Lord promised me that day. You yourself heard then that the Anakites were there, and their cities were large and fortified. But the Lord helping me, I will drive them out just as he said." Caleb's inheritance is really one of the most difficult of all the land to conquer. We saw with the original spies that this was the very city, the very area that caused their hearts to melt with fear, because this is where the Anakites or the giants lived. They said that they felt like grasshoppers in their presence. So we find that this is the land that Caleb has been given as his inheritance, and it says that he's 85 years of age, and yet we see that his faith has not wavered. He asked permission to go and complete the job that he wanted to do 45 years ago. His age makes no difference because the Bible says very specifically that he's as physically strong as he was back then. God gives special enabling for people when he calls them to the task, and apparently Caleb has not aged in this time, at least with regard to strength, because God has given him the faith and he will give him the victory over the Anakites. The city that's given to Caleb is Hebron, and he takes Hebron and the surrounding area for his own family. Now, Hebron's a name that should be very familiar to you by now. We saw it a lot back in Genesis. In fact, in Genesis 23, Sarah, the beloved wife of Abraham, died in Hebron. The patriarchs Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob spent a good portion of their lives when they lived in Canaan, near or in Hebron, and the cave of Machpelah, where all the patriarchs and their wives are buried, is also located near this area. So Caleb receives a lot of Israel's early memorial there in his land of inheritance. Now, though it's been given to Caleb and his family, we're going to see that in chapter 20, he's willing to return it back to the Lord as a tithe or a gift to the Lord because it becomes one of the six cities of refuge. Chapter 15 then takes us to the allotment of the 12 tribes. Normally when things like this are done, it always begins with the eldest son who receives the birthright, and then it goes all the way down to the youngest. Now, just a quick review, because we start with Judah, who's the fourth son. Why is it that we're not starting with the oldest? The oldest was Reuben. He forfeited the birthright because he had an incestuous relationship with his stepmother, Bilhah. So that put him out of the birthright. The second son, Simeon and Levi, also forfeited their right to the birthright with the situation at Shechem, where their sister Dinah was raped. And then, without their father's knowledge, they went in and had all the men circumcised, and while they were recovering, went in and murdered them all. So they were cursed rather than blessed when Jacob died. So that brings us then to the fourth son, who is Judah. And at the death of Jacob, he does give Judah the spiritual and the political family blessings of the firstborn. He's the one responsible to carry forward the name of Israel. And of course, we know that he is the one of which Messiah would come. So he, for all practical purposes now, becomes the leader of the 12 tribes and acts as a firstborn son. There's another portion of his blessing that he doesn't receive, and that's a double portion of land. And we're going to get to that in a moment, but Jacob gives that to his 11th son, who's Joseph. So the firstborn's inheritance is really split between Judah and Joseph, which is why we find these two tribes listed first. And I'll talk about Joseph when we get to that section. 15:1 opens up with, "Now the lot for the tribes of the son of Judah, according to their families." Now this little phrase, "according to their families," is important, because we know that the lots are cast and it's given to each tribe. But what that little phrase says is that once the tribe receives their large inheritance, then the same process is carried out, the casting of the lots, to subdivide it by clans, then by families, and eventually man by man, until everyone receives his inheritance. All of it is done in the presence of the Lord. Judah's land also includes two interesting locations. The first is the Valley of Achor, and that was the story in Jericho, when God said everything was to be given to him by fire, and a man named Achan from the tribe of Judah chose to keep for himself gold, silver, and a Babylonian robe, which resulted in the death of 36 men and the defeat of Israel at the next battle. And until that was made right, they could not continue. And of course, Joshua and the people came before the Lord and discovered the sin. And that's the only time that Israel lost any men in all of this. So the Valley of Achor is called the Valley of Trouble, and that is a perpetual reminder in the land of Judah. They also received a positive place, and that is Joshua's base camp of Gilgal, where they actually came in and were successful and conquered the promised land. Judah's land would guard Israel from the Edomites, and their northern border is shared with Benjamin. In fact, it's so close to Jerusalem that it's difficult to tell who actually has Jerusalem. In fact, in our lesson today, we talked about that, because in 15 verse 8, it says Judah receives the southern slope of Jerusalem. But in 15:63, it says they couldn't take the city itself. So Judah has the front yard, if you will, of Jerusalem, but it doesn't own the city or the house. Benjamin, on the other hand, in 19:27, is actually given the city. So maps are a bit confusing, because sometimes they have Jerusalem in the tribe of Judah, sometimes they have a tribe of Benjamin, but the city itself actually belongs to Benjamin, and yet the property, including Mount Moriah and Mount Zion, belong to Judah. In 15 verses 13 to 19, we come to Caleb's allotment again. It was in the central part of Judah, And as they were talking about the story of Judah, they mention again Debir. And Caleb now has conquered Hebron and the surrounding hills for himself, but he hasn't conquered Debir. Again, that's another one of those cities that Joshua conquered but had to be reconquered again. This little story in here is interesting because Caleb says that he will offer his daughter's hand in marriage along with a sizable dowry to anyone who would successfully recapture the city of Debir. The challenge is taken up by his nephew Othniel, who succeeds in taking Debir and then is rewarded with his cousin Achishan. Now her dowry that she brings along with her includes a very large section of the Negev, and we find a short story in verses 18 and 19. We read, "One day when she came to Othniel, she urged him to ask her father for a field. When she got off her donkey, Caleb had asked her, 'What can I do for you?' And she replied, 'Do me a special favor. Since you have given me the land in the Negev, give me also springs of water.' So Caleb gave her the upper and lower springs." This is kind of an odd story. It's difficult to understand, but apparently it parallels the story of Rebekah when she first met her husband Isaac back in Genesis 24, because both Rebekah and Achishan approach on an animal. Both of them get off their animal in a sign of respect. Both make a request and both receive an answer. What Achishan is asking her father for is water. She's been given very arid land in the Negev, and it's basically useless unless she has water. He, in return, gives her not only one spring, but two of them. What gets ambiguous in this text is her conversation with her husband Othniel, because she asks him to ask her father for a field. It appears that this field is where the water was, and most commentaries feel that the translation of this came across very poorly because they're not sure what she asked Othniel for, because she herself did the request of her father. The importance of this story here is because this water God had given as a blessing to Abraham. And so what this claim here of Caleb giving it to Othniel and Achishan does is says that the descendants of them now have this water source. It was given to them, it was documented. Even though God had given it to Abraham, it now belongs to Othniel and Achishan and their descendants. So that's kind of why the story was recorded here. Well, we go on with his second allotment, and that goes to Joseph, who I mentioned before, shares the birthright with Judah, the fourth son. Now, Joseph is son number 11, but if you remember back to Genesis, you remember that Jacob came to his uncle Laban and fell in love with Rachel. And he said, "I will work 7 years for you if you will give me Rachel as my bride." He works the 7 years free, and then on his wedding, he thinks he's getting Rachel, but his uncle Laban gives him Leah, the older daughter that Jacob doesn't love. He discovers the truth the next morning, but by that time it's too late. He's already married to Leah, and he's, "At the end of the week, I'll give you Rachel as your bride, and then you can work another 7 years for me, and then you can keep both my daughters." So Jacob works another 7 years, making a total of 14 years. Rachel is the one that he loves. Well, Rachel has two sons, and her oldest son is Joseph. Her youngest is Benjamin, and these are his last two sons. So really, Joseph is the son of love. He really, by all rights, should have been the firstborn son, because Jacob thought he was marrying Rachel, and their first son was Joseph. So he receives a double portion of the birthright, which would belong to the eldest son. We also know that he was treated specially with the coat of many colors, and we also learned that that was a very rare thing, and it also almost got him killed. Very interesting, though, because the portion that Joseph now receives is in the very heart of Canaan, and it is the most fruitful of all the land, which fulfills the blessings given by both Jacob to his son Joseph and Moses, who reiterates that Jacob had given Joseph the blessing. The tribes of Joseph include Ephraim and Manasseh. These are Joseph's two sons. And you saw in your lesson today that at Jacob's death, Joseph came with his sons, and Jacob says that these two sons, who I have seen with my eyes, now become part of Israel. Any sons you have born after my death, Joseph, they belong to you. But Ephraim and Manasseh will carry on the name of Israel. We also know that Manasseh was the older, and yet Jacob blessed Ephraim, the younger, over the older. When the allotment is drawn, though, it's the land given to Joseph, and then it's divided between Ephraim and Manasseh. Again, Ephraim is mentioned first, though he's the younger. He received the older blessing. It mentions that the Ephraimites did not drive out the inhabitants of Gezer. Now, you remember that Joshua and his troops killed the king and the warriors of Gezer, but they didn't go into the city itself. The king had come out to assist with Lachish, but they now, like the Gibeonites, become servants of Israel in exchange for their lives. So Gezer belongs to Ephraim. The people become servants. Now, by becoming servants, they were expected to put away all their idolatry. They were expected to be circumcised and to come into community with Israel. But we're going to see that history shows us a far different story. The city doesn't come under Israel's control. In fact, they're rebels all the way up until the days of Solomon. And they don't give up their idols, and they do continue on with their Canaanite ways. So that's just kind of setting us up for the future here. Included in Ephraim is the city of Shiloh, and we're going to see that that becomes Israel's first permanent sanctuary where the ark will rest. We go on to the son Manasseh, and his allotment begins with the territory given to Joseph and then details his southern border and finally his border with the other half of Manasseh. What we see here is the absence of towns, and that shows the great difficulty in settling the area where Manasseh is given because it's very heavily forested. Manasseh, as we know, is divided into two parts. Half of them are on the Transjordan side, and the remaining half is on the Canaan side. Two characters are mentioned with regard to Manasseh. Machir, who is the oldest son of Manasseh, the original son of Joseph, and he's mentioned as a man of war. And it's his descendants now that take the land of the Amorites, which is on the Transjordan side. Also, Machir's grandson is Zelophehad, and we've seen him now. This is the third mention. He was the test case back in Numbers. When he died, he left no sons but five daughters. And they said, well, how will we have an inheritance? Our father's name will die. And then the daughters were given the inheritance because there were no sons. Included in the Canaanite Manasseh's inheritance is Shechem, Mount Ebal, Mount Gerizim, and Samaria. All of these will become important in the future. The problem is mentioned in verses 17-12. It says, yet the Manassites were not able to occupy the towns, for the Canaanites were determined to live in that region. Now, some of the commentators suggest that they loved their ease, and they had disregarded God's command to drive them out. For some reason, they are willing to compromise, and they're willing to let the Canaanites live among them. Look at verse 14. The people of Joseph said to Joshua, why have you given us only one allotment and one portion for our inheritance? We are a numerous people, and the Lord has blessed us abundantly. Here they have just received the best of the land, God's abundant blessings, and if you look at the map, they have the largest land mass of any of the tribes, and yet they're complaining. And the reason they're complaining? Because they're too numerous. Why? Because God has already blessed them. Maybe they thought since Joshua was from their tribe, he would give them some sort of special deal. Joshua's response is in verse 15. He says, if you're so numerous, and if the hill country of Ephraim is too small for you, then go up into the forest and clear the land for yourself. The people are complaining because their allotment is not in an area where Joshua has already conquered it. So the enemy Canaanites are still a formidable foe. In fact, they mention that they have iron chariots. Now, this is significant because the chariots we've mentioned before apparently were a different kind. These iron chariots have long blades attached to their sides and axles, and as they go through, basically, they mow down or cut down anything that comes close to them. Joshua agrees that they are indeed numerous and powerful, and since they are, and since they already have two allotments instead of one, if they want more land, then they should go and work for it. What he does is he takes their very blessing from God, which they think is a problem, and turns it back around. He says, go up into the hills and clear it. There are a few cities up there. There's no chariots. You are large and you are powerful. You can drive them out. Now go and do it. So he kind of gives them a fatherly pep talk. You can do it. Come on. Chapters 18 and 19 then bring us to the division of the rest of the land. The story takes a stop here, which leads us to assume that now the tribes have been given their land. They're ready to move out. And the Transjordan tribes are ready to go home. So we find them moving now from Gilgal, which is in the south, to a more central location, which is Shiloh in the territory of Ephraim. The Ark of the Covenant is moving. That means the presence of the Lord is moving. And so we find the whole assembly gathering together one more time and moving up to Shiloh and making sure that the tent is set up and that the Ark is settled into its new home. This will become the temporary meeting place for Israel for the next 300 years. So I don't know how temporary that is. Once they're in Shiloh, though, the remaining seven tribes plus Levi seem perfectly content just to settle down right there with the spoils of the war that they already have. Look at Joshua's comments in 18 verse 3. How long will you wait before you begin to take possession of the land the Lord, the God of your fathers, have given you? Sounds like a parent again. He says, come on, guys. What are you waiting for? This time he commissions 21 men, three from the remaining seven tribes, and he says, go through the whole land, map it out, record the cities, divide it into seven equal portions, and then bring it back down, and then we'll cast lots before the Lord to determine who the remaining inheritance will go to. Well, that's done, and the first lot says that Benjamin will receive the first section. He receives the land between Joseph and Judah, and we talked about this already. Benjamin receives the city of Jerusalem itself, and yet they are unable to capture it in their inheritance. The second one goes to Simeon. Again, Simeon had been cursed. He was the second son, and we find that he actually takes part of Judah's territory, but that's only temporary. He's basically swallowed up within Judah. Of all the Bible characters, every tribe has some remarkable person in biblical history except for Simeon. He seems to just disappear into Judah. Zebulun is third. He's given the lower Galilee. That includes Nazareth. Issachar gets the Jezreel Valley, River Kishon, the mountains of Gilboa, and the valley of Megiddo. All those will be important in the life of Israel. Asher's on the Mediterranean coast up north and gets the great seaports of Tyre and Sidon. Naphtali is the farthest inland north, and they get the upper Galilee and also the waters of Merom, where Joshua and Israel battled the northern kings that was led by Jabin of Hazor. Dan receives his inheritance last. He gets between Benjamin and the sea. However, we're going to see in the book of Judges that he is unable to take his land. He loses it to the Philistines, so he goes way up north into Leshem in the northern portion of Naphtali and settles there and changes the name to Dan, and he actually holds the uppermost or the northernmost portion of the promised land. It seems appropriate that Dan would receive his inheritance last because he served as the rear guard for the traveling through the wilderness. Well, Joshua's waited until all the tribes received their inheritance before he takes any for himself. This was a way of showing that he was not abusing any of his leadership. Even though this was all done according to God's will with Eleazar the high priest presiding, Joshua requests, after everything has been given now, that he would receive Timnah-Serah as his inheritance. And we notice that it's in Ephraim, which is his tribe. Chapter 29 brings us to the towns of refuge. God gave the land of promise to Israel as a gift. And you remember we talked about that. The first fruits of everything goes back to the Lord, and now the first fruits of their inheritance also is returned to the Lord. They're to give back a portion of their land to be used by God for specific purposes. The cities of refuge were to be set aside now by the inadvertent killer to keep him safe from the blood avenger, and we studied this in Exodus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. The law distinguished very clearly between premeditated murder and accidental murder. Premeditated required the death penalty, but if it was accidental and the killer was killed by the blood avenger and it was not premeditated, then his blood would be considered innocent and it would defile the land. So God set up six cities all within a day of every place within the promised land that they could flee to until they arrives at a city of refuge. He's to stand at the entrance of the city gate and state his case. After he stated his case, then the elders would hear it and they would allow him to come into the city until he had a trial. Also interesting is that his trial was held in his home village. saying that this wasn't premeditated murder, he would then return to the city of refuge and spend the rest of his life there, essentially in prison. But he would not receive the death penalty. If he ever left that city, then the avenger of blood, which was the nearest relative of the person that was killed, would be required by law to kill him because he was not intentional murder. The only time the killer was released was at the death of the high priest, and chances are that wouldn't happen during their lifetime. But when a high priest died and he represented the Messiah, then his blood paid the penalty for all sins at that moment, so everybody would be released from the cities of refuge. So we find that 6 cities are given as refuge. That leaves 42 other cities for the Levites, and they would be scattered throughout all of the territories. According to their description and size, we find that most of these Levitical towns are more or less small hamlets with just a very few houses. They're not these big fortified cities. It's interesting because we find that all the inheritance have been given, and now the family heads of the Levites come before Joshua, Eleazar, and the other tribal leaders and request their allotment just as Judah had done in the beginning. Their allotment was done as the Lord had commanded. God has already explained that they were to tithe back a portion of their land, and so these towns are chosen by lot again, and they were divided between the 4 groups of Levites. The Kohathites were divided into 2. The priests, which were the direct descendants of Aaron, and they were placed near Jerusalem for obvious reasons. The other Kohathites were responsible for the Ark of the Covenant and other tabernacles, and they're actually given central hill country as their section. The Gershonites are the ones that carry the tent coverings, the textiles, and they receive Levitical towns on the Transjordan side. You notice today that 48 towns were received. That was the exact number that was given back in Numbers. They were carefully organized and listed, and copies of this were kept as a history or a genealogy that people could refer to so that they rightfully claim that they were descendants of Levi. Well, we conclude the allotments in 21 verses 43 and 45. It emphasizes now the fulfillment of God's promise and the completeness of the victory. God had promised the patriarchs that the land would belong to their descendants. And we have seen this throughout all of Joshua. Look at verse 43. Not one of their enemies withstood them. The Lord handed all their enemies over to them. Not one of all the Lord's good promises to the house of Israel failed. Every one was fulfilled. The emphasis here is on the defeat of the enemies, and the accomplishment was due to God's swearing that this would happen. The resulting victory then brought rest from major wars. All God had promised them has now occurred. What stands out is that God was faithful to his promise. Although they haven't destroyed all the Canaanites, they have taken out all the military power, if you will. All the influential kings, all the armies, all the major cities now belong to Israel. From this point on, it was to be a process that God would take tribe by tribe and remove all the Canaanites from the land. Israel had begun it under God, and they would continue it under God if they would obey. Unfortunately, as we continue on with our study of the book of Judges, Samuel, and Kings, we find out that the nation's failure to complete the process and claim what God had already given them was due to their lack of obedience to God. Looking at this lesson, it was very interesting to see how the different tribes reacted differently. And each of these tribes, I'm told, really took on the characteristic of the original son. So they have distinctive personalities. One of the things we noticed was with the tribes of Joseph. What they thought was their weakness, and the reason they had too many people, was because God had blessed them. They were also a strong people. And Joshua pointed out, yes, your land is small, but you are large. And that is an asset to you, because if you use your strength, if you use your numbers, then you can go in and conquer much more land, and then you will have all the land that you need. And I thought about this. I thought, I wonder how many times we look at our own lives and say, you know, I have this real and is used for him, it becomes our blessing and our greatest strength. Something to think about. Let's pray. Lord, we come before you right now. We've come to a milestone in your word. We started out in the book of Genesis where you promised your servant Abraham this very land. And here we are several hundred years after that event, and we find that your promise was fulfilled in every single detail. Everything that you said you would do, you did. Part of the people to claim which you had already given to them. You had given them victory after victory, and all they had to do was basically show up. And yet they turned their faith away from you and looked at their problems. I pray that you would help us in our lives, that we would keep our focus on you, that as you show us promises in your word, that we would lay claim to them, and that we would do our part to claim the victories that you have already given to us. We love you, Lord. Thank you for the privilege of studying your word. Amen.